Good morning, everyone. It may be actually a very late good evening in Hong Kong, and certainly it's a good afternoon to Lord Chris Patten in London. I'm Larry Diamond. I'm a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and I will lead this new program on China's global sharp power that we're going to have a conversation about today. It's my pleasure to welcome you and to introduce our two conversants. Condoleezza Rice is the Tad and Diane Toby Director of the Hoover Institution and the Thomas and Barbara Stevenson Senior Fellow at Hoover on Public Policy. And of course, you know, she was the 66th Secretary of State of the United States. And prior to that, 2001 to 2005, she was the National Security Advisor to President George W. Bush. We are extremely honored and thrilled to have her joined in conversation today by Lord Chris Patten. He has served as Chancellor of the University of Oxford since 2003. And he's perhaps best known for his role as Britain's last governor of Hong Kong from 1992 until the transfer of sovereignty to the People's Republic of China on July 1st, 1997. His career in politics and government began in 1979 when he was first elected to Parliament. He also served as chairman of the Conservative Party, Europe's Commissioner for External Affairs, and chairman of the BBC Trust. And he also chaired the International Crisis Group for 7 years. Lord Patten is the author of several books, including most recently, First Confession, A Sort of Memoir. He has been a steadfast and deeply admired voice in defense of Hong Kong's freedom and rule of law, and a forthright critic of China's authoritarian behavior. So Condi and Chris, thank you so much. And over to you, Condi.
Thank you very much, Larry. And let me just say, from the perspective of the Hoover Institution, we're very excited about this project on Chinese sharp power. Undoubtedly, the rise of China and how to manage that rise for geopolitical prosperity and peace, but also for the rights of free peoples so that democracy can flourish. It's one of the most important geopolitical challenges really of many, many decades. And this Hoover Project on Sharp Power is going to bring together people from all over who will help us understand better what China is doing and then to understand better how to meet those policy challenges. And I couldn't be more thrilled today than to welcome my friend and colleague, Lord Chris Patten, to talk about one of the most important aspects of that, which is how to think about China, how to think about Hong Kong, how to think about China's global rise, and there's no better person to do that. So welcome to you, Chris. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Secretary. And I've occasionally done things with Hoover before, and it's always a great pleasure. And I know the project you're engaged in now is really important for our future relations with China, for the future of open societies, and in particular for the future of universities in open societies.
Absolutely. And Lord Patten and I are going to be informal here. I'm going to call him Chris and he's going to call me Condi, if that's all right with everyone. And let me just start, Chris, with a kind of broad historical question, taking you back to the negotiations that were conducted with the People's Republic of China to allow sovereignty to be handed back to China over Hong Kong. You were the last governor. You were deeply involved in those negotiations and deeply involved in the expectation and the hope that China would live up to the idea of one country, two systems, preserving the freedoms and the unique status of Hong Kong, preserving for all of those who live in Hong Kong and have prospered in Hong Kong, the ability to continue to do so. So let me take you back to that period. How did you think about it at the time? And Did you think that China was actually going to live up to those obligations? I assume you did, or you wouldn't have signed. What did you think at the time? What did you think the challenges were at the time?
The whole system or the whole concept of one country, two systems was very difficult for both Britain and China. But it covered a real awkwardness, both political and moral, on both sides. For the Chinese, Hong Kong represented one of the lowest points in Qing history, a great humiliation by a colonial power. But they also knew that more than half the population of Hong Kong were refugees from events in communist China, literally more than half. On the British side, it was awkward because we were a bit embarrassed by our history, by that period of the Opium Wars and so on. And we also were in a position in which, unlike every other colony, we weren't able to prepare the territory for independence with democracy. And when in the 1970s and 80s, there were attempts to push democracy, I think, frankly, Britain was too slow in reacting, but it was also pressed very hard by China not to do that, because the Chinese used to say, if you do that, you'll be giving people in Hong Kong the impression that they're going to be like Singapore or Malaysia or wherever, and they're going to become an independent democratic state, and that's not on the agenda. Chou Enlai said that to British interlocutors. So it was difficult. It was negotiated in 1984, international treaty, to guarantee Hong Kong's way of life, the rule of law, as well as the freedoms of around the economy, all the liberties of a free society. Sam Finer, in his great magisterial book on different sorts of government, has one chapter on a society which is liberal but not fully democratic, and the only example he could find was Hong Kong. So it was on the way to democracy. My job when I got to Hong Kong was to try to stand up for what had already been agreed, not to go beyond the treaty, not to go beyond the constitution which the Chinese had put in place, but to stand up for the international covenant on civil and political rights, to try to develop accountable structures, and to try, above all, to encourage people to believe in the freedoms which had helped to make them so prosperous. Somebody once called it a sort of tutorial government. And I was encouraged to believe that the Chinese would go along with what they'd signed up to. My biggest critic at the time was a very distinguished British diplomat. He'd been ambassador in Beijing. He tended to think that the right's approach to Beijing was, by and large, after a bit of huffing and puffing, to do whatever they wanted. And he wrote on one occasion, of course, he said, the Chinese leaders are thuggish dictators, but they're men of their word, he said, and they will deliver what they promised. Well, we know that that's partly true. They're certainly thuggish dictators, as we can see in Xinjiang at the moment. But again and again, on one issue after another, they've broken their word, whether it's on the international health regulations, whether it's on South China Sea, or whether it's on Hong Kong. And one further point about Hong Kong, actually, for about 10 years after 1997, things went reasonably well. What changed was Xi Jinping, the real nervousness that the Chinese started to have about the threat that liberal democracy, that open societies and their values make to a totalitarian, technocratic surveillance state. And I think that one reason why they've been so tough on Hong Kong is that Hong Kong represents all those values which they deplore. Civic society, democratic accountability, rule of law, independent courts, education which allows people to develop as you would want to develop yourself without having the party line thrust down your throat. So all those reasons, freedom of speech, all those things they saw in Hong Kong and they thought represented a real existential threat to the Communist Party and its control in Beijing. So I think what's happened is deeply worrying. And I have to say, I actually did think in 1997 that while it wouldn't be easy, they weren't going to simply turn turtle. Indeed, I used to think that the longer things went on, the more likely it was that China would behave reasonably well about Hong Kong.
You make a very interesting point, Chris, which is that we sometimes don't think about the interaction between what goes on in Hong Kong and what goes on in China. It sits right there. In some ways, many people said perhaps Hong Kong will infect China, not the other way around. And perhaps that's how the leadership actually saw it. You made a very interesting point that for 10 years or so, things went reasonably well. The crackdowns, and we've seen now just sort of steady erosion of Hong Kong's status. But can you go back just a little bit and you talked about Xi Jinping. Is it really just Xi Jinping, or do you think that it has to do with a China that as it matures, as it sees that its prosperity has really been its legitimacy with its people, and yet it's getting harder and harder to deliver for the higher expectations of people, was there something going on in China itself that made Hong Kong even more threatening, or was it just Xi Jinping who saw it differently?
Well, I think, first of all, it is inconceivable for a Hong Kong leader, for a Chinese leader, for a leader of the Communist Party, that there can be people in Hong Kong who may love China but don't love the Communist Party. And that they find impossible because, as you know, love China, love the Communist Party. The two are supposed to be the same thing. But I do think that from around 2010, 2011, there was growing concern in China about the impact of globalization, of urbanization, of developments in the internet, at the same time as they were spooked by that quasi-coup or attempted coup by Bo Xilai. And I think that convinced them from 2011 onwards. There was a party meeting in 2011 when the communique was actually drafted under a committee chaired by Xi Jinping, in which they asserted the importance of cracking down on culture, on education, on religion, on civil society, on human rights lawyers, and so on and so on. And the first thing that happened after 2013, when Xi Jinping became leader, was what's famously called communique number 9, which was the instruction to the party, to the military, and to government officials to recognize that the main threat to the Communist Party came from liberal values. It's an extraordinary litany from, as I said earlier, civic society, parliamentary democracy, historical nihilism, in other words, telling people what happened in Tiananmen, freedom of speech, and so on. And when people say that there isn't really a battle of values, a war of values, there is. You just have to read what the Chinese communist leadership have been saying to people. And I think it was very much related to their sense that they couldn't keep a tight grip on what was happening in China. And if they once started to allow the sentiments that were underpinned Hong Kong's success to infiltrate China. I think there's one other thing, which you may think is a slightly absurd proposition, but I know enough people who are knowledgeable about China who believe this to be true. One of the main intellectual supporters of Xi Jinping was Wang Qishan, who was the Chinese head of the discipline committee of the anti-corruption drive. And before that, he was a vice premier dealing with the economy. Way before that, he was one of the few leaders who wasn't an electrical engineer or whatever. He was actually a museum curator. And he was obsessed. We met him in Oxford a few years ago. He was obsessed with Tocqueville, and not with democracy in America, but Tocqueville on the Ancien Régime. And if you look at sales of Tocqueville's book on the Ancien Régime, which I had to do for history at Oxford 100 years ago, if you look at sales, they spike at a certain point. Everybody in the Central Party School is required to read Tocqueville. Why? Because they thought that Tocqueville had two particular lessons for them. First, that people don't become easier to govern just because they're getting better off. Indeed, if you look at 18th century France, it was exactly the reverse. Secondly, authoritarian regimes are always, always, always at their weakest and most vulnerable when they try to reform and when they try to change. And I do believe that the only plausible reason for the fantastic sale of Tocqueville's Ancien Régime in China is that the Chinese leadership actually took those 2 points very seriously.
It's a very interesting point. And of course, from my own perspective, I remember very well the tremendous, tremendous fear of the Gorbachev effect, that Gorbachev had in fact been foolish to think that communism could be reformed. And many said it was going to work differently in China, of course, because they had already reformed the economy, they had economic prosperity going for them. Now they could, in a sense, afford political reform because they had a base of legitimacy, which of course the Soviets did not have. But I remember very well after 1989, Tiananmen Square was a very clear signal that they were not going to go the Gorbachev route, which would then allow the, because reforming authoritarianism is dangerous. So I resonate very much with that comment. Before we go to China's broader role and then ultimately how to deal with it, I'd like to just briefly take you back to Hong Kong and have you talk a little bit about how you see Hong Kong's future. It is actually, after all, a place that was important to China as a kind of offshore with rule of law, with a banking system that worked, where it was actually important to China's economy. Have they given up on that importance? Do they think they can have it both ways? Or are they trying to crush Hong Kong in favor of Shanghai as a banking system? How do you think they think about it, and what do you think that means for the future of Hong Kong?
Well, as a contribution to the overall Chinese GDP, Hong Kong's position has, of course, changed. When I left Hong Kong, and this wasn't post hoc propter hoc, when I left Hong Kong, Hong Kong's GDP was not far short of a fifth of China's, but with just 7 million people. Today, I guess that Hong Kong's economy is about 3% of China's. It's still very important, but because of what's happened to the Chinese economy in the last 25 years, Hong Kong's contribution in that sense is smaller. But Hong Kong is enormously important for inward investment into China and for China's ability to be part of a global economy, which is largely working in dollar denomination. And it's hugely important. It's very important for IPOs. About 70% of IPO is done through Hong Kong from Chinese companies. Why are there so many hedge funds in Hong Kong? Because hedge funds, like others, see the importance of the relationship between a free market, free flow of information, and the rule of law. And if you take away two of those things, and think you can manage with the sort of cronyism and so on, which apply and no free and no rule of law, which apply in the whole of China, you do run real financial and other risks. My guess is that for some time to come, the Chinese authorities will be pressing Chinese mainland companies to do as much through the Hong Kong stock market and Hong Kong institutions as possible in order to try to buoy up the economy for a bit. But there's no question that if you take away freedom of information and the rule of law, you make a big impact on a society and economy which has been one of the best examples of the relationship between economic and political freedom working symbiotically. And I think that's been the great secret and the great story of Hong Kong. So I think that what China has done in Hong Kong will have an impact on China's international role. And the United States, if it was tougher than it has been, could make that even more difficult. But it is a problem. If Hong Kong just looks as though it's another part of China, how does the rest of the world treat it? Can it still be an independent member of the World Trade Organization? What about its role in the IMF? All those issues are bound to come up. If you're treated exactly the same in Hong Kong, well, let me give one example, or other example. In 2013, there was a huge boom in the Shanghai stock market, very much encouraged by Xi Jinping, the new emperor. When that crashed, immediately the censors moved in, first of all, to remove any reference to Xi Jinping's encouragement of investment in the stock market, and secondly, to discourage any mention of the fact that there'd been a crash. Now, if those sort of things apply, start to apply in Hong Kong, and what happens when a newspaper in Hong Kong starts to look very hard at the books of an SOE, of a state-owned enterprise, even a private sector company, which matters to the Chinese mainland. What happens when they do that? Are they prosecuted? Are they turfed out? Do they have their visa removed? It's going to be very difficult.
Yes. You said something that I just have to ask you to expound upon. You said, if the United States were willing to get tougher, can you just talk a little bit about, do you not think that the response to Hong Kong has been tough enough? And then I'd like to broaden this out then to China's policy more broadly. So, but have we done the right things about Hong Kong?
Yeah, I think you've been pretty tough. And I recall that when I was governor of Hong Kong, I used to go every year from Hong Kong to Washington to argue in favor of most favored nation status for China and Hong Kong and for treating Hong Kong separately. And I think it's understandable that you've determined that Hong Kong has to be treated as part of China. But you could have gone, I'm glad you haven't gone further, because I think you've distinguished between the impact on mega Hong Kong and the impact on ordinary people. And I think you've tried very hard not to make the normal citizens of Hong Kong bear the brunt. And I think that's a very difficult line to tread, but I think you've done it pretty skillfully so far. But you could, of course, have gone much further in what you did about international financial activities that come out of Hong Kong. But I think you've played that hand pretty well. What I would hope that the United States and the Five Eyes countries in particular, all being Anglophone, would do is more for example, young people in Hong Kong who want to study in Anglophone universities. I think it would be a very, very good initiative for the Five Eyes to take to a launch a sort of freedom scholarship for young Hong Kongers with bursaries in universities in Canada, US, Australia, New Zealand, and the UK. And you wouldn't need very much money in order to do it. So there are other things that can be done. But at the moment, I think that the most important thing as far as the US dealing with China and Hong Kong is concerned is for the US to avoid giving the impression that it's having to dragoon other countries into supporting it. I think this is an interest that we all share, how we manage the world in the next few years, given the fact that we're dealing with a large economy, which is probably at peak. I can come back to that later if you'd like, which is capable of such mendacious and loutish behavior.
Let's talk about that mendacious and loutish behavior. This is a project on Chinese sharp power. And of course, it's meant to contrast with those who wanted to talk about Chinese soft power, for instance, through Belt and Road or efforts to change the nature of the way people thought about China. And even something like Belt and Road, their investment in infrastructure program across much of the developing world has a sharp edge to it. If you can't pay that loan back, then we own it. So actually, China has been pretty aggressive and pretty sharp. Can you talk a little bit about how you see the broader nature of the challenge from China in the various aspects in economics and in security? You mentioned the Five Eyes, of course, the intelligence cooperatives, but countries that deeply cooperate on intelligence, Australia, Canada, et cetera. Can you talk a little bit about how you see China's global geopolitical footprint and how they're carrying it out? Are they wise in what they're doing?
No, I don't think they're wise. There is a tendency on the part of others to think that it's all a brilliant and carefully calculated plan. It goes back to that famous story about, I think it was Henry Kissinger's first visit to Beijing, and he asked Zhou Enlai what the lessons of the French Revolution, of the revolution in France were. And Zhou Enlai says it's too early to tell, and everybody thinks that's fantastically wise. The interpreter afterwards pointed out that he was actually talking about 1989, about the students in Paris in 89, rather than the 18th century French Revolution. So we tend, I think, to exaggerate their great wisdom. I think they've behaved rather foolishly. They've obviously taken advantage of the fact that in the last months, our concentration has been on the dealing with the coronavirus, and there are arguments which we will have, I hope, in due course, about how much the Chinese are responsible for the appalling ravages of that pandemic, because they simply didn't live up to their obligations under the international health regulations of 2005-2007, where you're supposed to declare concerns about a public health problem within 24 hours, and we know what actually happened. I think they've overplayed their hand. I think they've done that with India. Why choose this moment to start a border fight with India? They've clearly done it in the South China Sea, where they've broken every commitment they made to President Obama. And you can see, I think one or two of your think tanks have produced the aerial evidence of what's been happening. We know about the ramming of Vietnamese fishing boats in the South China Sea. They've done it in relation to Hong Kong, and their continuing bullying of Taiwan. And if you were in Taiwan and wanted to know what would happen to you if you went along with China's policies, then Hong Kong's a pretty appalling example. So I don't think they've handled themselves particularly skillfully, to put it mildly. But it is true that, to go back to a phrase I used earlier, I think we're at peak China. I think this is the moment when China is going to feel more muscularity than it's likely to in the future. What's the problem in the future? The problems are severalfold. Above all, demography, drought, and debt. And they are all going to be huge problems for China. The other one, which perhaps raises questions about how much confidence they actually have in this technological totalitarianism, is they're huge nervous about liberal democracies, about the sort of things that you and I take for granted, whether it's freedom of speech or civic society or whatever. And I do think that reflects a real worry on their part about the existential threat which our values pose to them. And it's why I keep on coming back to the point that I don't think this is a cold war at the moment, but it's certainly a war, it's certainly a conflict of values, and we've got to stand up for what we believe in. And we've got to do it by working together. And the way we're picked off one at a time by what the Financial Times has called coercive commercial diplomacy, it's pathetic on our part. If you're bullied, you stand up for yourself. And if your friend is bullied, you stand up for your friend. I noticed the other day that an example of political irony with Chinese characteristics, that when somebody suggested that the young Democrats in Hong Kong should be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, Wang Yi said it would be monstrous to politicize the Nobel Peace Prize. Well, where was he when Liu Xiaobo was given the prize? And the Chinese immediately made clear that they wouldn't buy anything more from Norway for years to come. Actually, after that, Norway's exports to China went up. And if you look at salmon, which was a particular sale, salmon sales to Vietnam spiked, and salmon sales from Vietnam to China spiked. So a lot of it's bluff. But nevertheless, we shouldn't let them get away with it. We have working together, not trying to contain China, but to constrain China, as Gerald C. Siegel used to say, and to oblige them to stick to the rules. When they don't stick to the rules, which they don't, particularly perhaps in commercial affairs, when they don't stick to the rules, we have to call them out on it. Just to add one point, it's extremely interesting to compare from time to time the Chambers of Commerce annual reports in Beijing. American, European, Japanese, they all say the same things about China. They've all got the same grumbles about intellectual property theft, about the difficulty of investing in China, about the way in which China takes a completely different attitude to investing in other countries than they allow to invest in China. It's inconceivable that the Chinese would have allowed a German company to buy its main AI company in the way that the Chinese were allowed to buy the main German AI company. So I think we have to work together. I think it's the most important aspect of multilateralism with China. And one thing I think I beg us all to do is to be open about it, not to think we have to be secretive in the way we do these things. The more we talk about how we're going to do things differently with China, the better it is, and the less likely we'll have to actually have endless rows with them. We do have to work with China on a number of issues where there are global public goods, but I think I hope that our own government in Britain will look hard at where we're dependent on particular Chinese technological exports, where we're over-dependent on other things, and will work to deal with that.
I want to come to the technological cooperation, competition with China in just a moment, but let me just ask you a rather specific question. How concerned are you around some of the blustering around Taiwan? It's been for a long time American policy that no one should try to change the status quo, and that message has always been delivered to Beijing, but also delivered to Taiwan. But the language about Taiwan, the military positioning around Taiwan, are we seeing some kind of sea change with Xi Jinping? Does he have different aspirations about Taiwan? How do you think about this situation? Are we looking at a period of greater vulnerability for Taiwan?
I think if Xi Jinping thought he could get away with it, he'd try it. I don't know any other way in which you can explain the big naval buildup by China. I used to write quite a lot about Disraeli, and I was always struck by the fact that people used to say he wrote all these novels about social problems and about helping the working class, and then when he was prime minister, he did something about it. There wasn't any relationship between the two. I think you have to take what people say sometimes rather seriously. And I think if we were to give the impression to Xi Jinping that we wouldn't care if he put the squeeze harder on Taiwan, and even if he intervened militarily, then it would encourage him to behave really stupidly. And I think there are one or two things that we could and should do, which would be regarded by China as provocative and be regarded by some liberal democracies, some Western societies as provocative, but I think make a great deal of sense. For example, the fact that Taiwan is denied membership of the World Health Conference run by the World Health Organization. It used to be a member until 2017. And then the Chinese threw it out, even while I think the Knights of Malta or Jerusalem and others are all allowed observer status. I think that overwhelmingly the financial support of the WHO, quite rightly, comes from rich countries, comes from rich democracies and individual donors in those democracies. And I think I don't want us to withdraw from the WHO, though I think they behave pretty pathetically in the early days of the coronavirus. It's the only WHO we've got. But I do think we should insist come the next World Health Conference, which I think is next May, I do think we should insist on seating Taiwan as an observer. It's those sort of things which would show that we're actually concerned, we're not trying to go back on the one China policy, but we are insisting that China should treat Taiwan with a modicum of civility. And if China had behaved over the coronavirus as well as Taiwan did, we wouldn't all have the problem we've got today. You were talking about Tiananmen just now. I was in Tiananmen until a week before the massacres in and around the square, and I was there as a ministerial vice president of the Asian Development Bank, and it was taking place in Beijing that year, and it was taking place, and everybody thought the exciting issue was going to be the fact that Taiwan Taipei was allowed to take part in it. That was all those years ago. In fact, as you know, while the ADB meeting was taking place, Gorbachev, you referred to this earlier, was arriving in Beijing, and the Chinese were grotesquely embarrassed by the fact that there was this revolution en fête going on in the streets that Gorbachev could see, and I think that had some impact on the way they've actually behaved. But they've actually dealt with these issues of seating Taiwan in international fora before, and we should make a point of insisting on it without going back on the one China policy.
Yes. One of the places that we're likely to be competitors, even in some cases in conflict, is in the technological sphere. Some have said that we are effectively becoming two separate technological universes, two separate technological spheres. If you look, for instance, at the internet, the Chinese view of the internet, which is a means of social control and the granting of social credits and watching who you talk to and judging your patriotism by it, our view, with variations among Western and democratic countries, but you can pretty much go on the internet and say what you think and talk to whom you please, and there's really no great fear that the government, at least, is going to do something about that, unless you're talking to terrorists. So they're really kind of irreconcilable views of the internet. And so I can see that you're going to see separation there. But how far do you think that separation is going to go? You mentioned not selling major technological companies to China. We have now in the United States stronger oversight of Chinese investment in any company, but particularly technological ones, through our Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, which mandate has been broadened to look at those issues. So how far is this going to go? Are we really going to become two separate technological universes? Will there continue to be some overlap? How do you see that here in Silicon Valley? That's a big question, because a lot of particularly venture firms and the like are actually invested in Chinese companies. So how do you see this evolving?
Well, I'm a complete neophyte on anything technological. But I feel strongly about three things. First of all, unless we're prepared to accept the possibility of two different technological spheres, we'll fetch up with one, and it'll be Chinese. And that worries me inordinately. When we were debating Huawei and in its role in 5G in the UK, very few people pointed out the extent to which Huawei was involved in Xinjiang, in the surveillance activities in Xinjiang, like that other company, which I think is called Hikvision. So I think there are real issues that we have to face up to. Secondly, I think that one way in which we have to face up to them is by recognizing the importance from time to time of greater public funding of high-tech development. And if it was really true that Huawei was better than Siemens or Ericsson as European companies, then that's an argument for us trying to work with Siemens and Ericsson and invest more with them. Thirdly, we know perfectly well that one area where China will be trying to steal our intellectual property is technology, is high tech. It's not, I think, particularly a problem for us in Oxford. I'd be more worried about them trying to pick up stuff from our life sciences, where I think we're world beating or as good as. I do think we have to be very, very cautious about, for example, the relationship between universities and military universities in China, where we've I think been fairly pathetic. So I think there are issues of public investment. I think there are issues of research collaboration, and I think that unless we're prepared to try to develop our own high-tech equipment, we'll fetch up excessively dependent on Chinese.
Well, you just mentioned a place that I wanted to go, which is to talk about universities. In the United States, there has long been, really going back to the end of World War II, a very close relationship between universities that produce fundamental research, even applied research that then becomes commercialized and has in fact kind of driven the revolution in technology. If you look at just about any breakthrough technology in the United States over the period after World War II, universities have had something to do with it. Particularly since we no longer have the great labs like Bell Laboratories, which was the source of so many Nobel Prizes over a long period of time. So universities are key. It's been a relationship that has worked because the federal government has been willing to fund research without really getting into the details of what the research was supposed to produce. So funding fundamental research and recognizing that you can never tell where fundamental research is really going, but it's gone in good directions. It's gone through the National Science Foundation, through the NIH, National Institutes for Health, when it's about biotech or about health issues. And it's through even the Defense Department, which has had a huge role in funding university research. We now come to a point where the question of what the Chinese are doing to mine that research from universities through Chinese students, through Chinese postdoctoral students. Some would even say the funding of on-campus activities by the Chinese Communist Party, some in the humanities, some not. That relationship is a bit fraught now between the openness of the university and what the Chinese are doing. What has been your experience at Oxford? You mentioned the biosciences, where Oxford is very, very powerful. What's been your experience? How do you think about this? How do we balance the openness of universities and the belief that knowledge doesn't have boundaries with a Chinese view that, yes, knowledge does have boundaries. It ought to serve the interests of the Chinese Communist Party and of the Chinese military. How do we think about that?
Well, first of all, anybody who doesn't think about it, who's got anything to do with the university, hasn't read the Chinese policy paper called Patriotic Education from 2019, or hasn't read the latest work on the extent to which SOEs, state-owned enterprises in the private sector, and their research programs in particular, are part of United Front activity. Trained on these, securing the successful implementation of China's narrative. I think there are three real issues that we have to face up to. And it's, I think, more of an issue for us in Europe and, or particularly in Britain and Australia, than it is perhaps for you in this sense, that we've become more dependent on funding of through Chinese students, partly because the Australian and British governments haven't spent enough on funding higher education themselves, and partly as well because we don't have as much of experience of philanthropic giving to higher education and alumni giving back to their educational institutions. So that's not true at Oxford, but it's true of most of a lot of universities. At Oxford, about a year ago, we turned down a big project with Huawei. And the assumption was that this was because of me. I didn't know about it until I read about it on the front page of the Financial Times. It was because our own academics had thought, this is not a very good idea. So I'm content, by and large, at our university to depend on their good sense. But overall, I think there are two or three things which we in the research area which we should be aware of. First of all, I'm very much in favor, without having the government deciding what research we do, to actually have a point, an entry point in government where we can go and ask whether issues are going to be really awkward in security or other terms. Secondly, I think that it's really important for us to be open about where the funding for research is coming from and where the funding of people's individual posts is coming from. Occasionally what happens is, as you will know, is the most active proponents of open field for China are academics who have themselves posts in China as well as in Western societies. I don't wish to point any fingers, but we know that's true. So to be open about where the funding's coming from and whether people have posts which are funded partly by Chinese state or private donors, I think those points about openness are extremely important. I think we can deal with those in Britain. I think we can deal with those issues of big research projects reasonably well. I'm more worried about how we cope with big student populations. I mean, if you're a student at a Chinese university, you're used to there being cameras in the classroom, cameras in the lecture theatre, and you know, presumably, that there are paid narcs. There are people recruited as informants to tell the state and paid and promised research projects at the end. I'm not making this up. One knows it to be true. And if you look at the Chinese policies on higher education and the extent to which universities are regarded as the way you put the finishing touches to China Man, resisting any influence from the West, so that even I noticed the other day Thomas Piketty had to deny that his book could be published in China because they wanted to censor it. So if that's China's higher education, then it does pose problems for us, not just in collaborating, but also in how we deal with Chinese and mainland student and Hong Kong students when they're with us. It's a real problem, I think. So I hope we'll be open to it, and I hope we'll talk to one another about it. I mean, I noticed that there's a report in the Financial Times today about both Oxford and Princeton deciding that in the social sciences, in Chinese history, people will be, when they produce essays, they'll be done anonymously, so they can't be used against them under the national security law, which has now been passed. These are big and difficult issues for us to tackle, and we mustn't be seduced by the fact that we've become, in Britain and Australia so dependent on the income stream from Chinese students and to duck them? These are really important issues, and universities, in my view, it sounds rather old-fashioned, I know, are, I think, still pillars of open societies.
We have a number of questions that have come in, and I just want to pose, they're grouped around Hong Kong, many of which you've already answered, but there are also a couple of questions about the future. And so I'm going to ask you, and now condensing a number of the questions that we have here, is there any way to influence the internal development of China? Is there, given that they've delivered 500 million people out of poverty, some people would say this is a government that is popular with its people. How do you think about influencing? And then a number of questions that really say, all right, and so if you were governing in the UK or the United States, what would you do about the Chinese global rise and Chinese sharp power? What's your advice to those who have to deal with China?
Well, on the first point, I think our ability to alter Chinese internal behavior is pretty limited, except by the way in which we helped, you know more about this than I do, to change behavior in the Soviet Union and Russia, and that is by the way we behave ourselves. If we are clearly running successful open societies, if what Chinese students see when they come to America or Britain or Australia is a really successful society with openness, with all sorts of freedoms which we take for granted, if they see that, and if that's generally the impression that gets back to China, then I think that has more impact on China than anything, though I don't deny the importance of public diplomacy. But I don't think we're going to convert Xi Jinping or his acolytes anytime soon to a belief in Tocqueville's views on democracy in America rather than the views on the French Revolution. So I think the way we behave is enormously important. And secondly, which is related to the second question as well, it seems to me imperative for us to work together, and imperative for the sort of cooperation we've seen with the Five Eyes to be more general. And I know, as well as anybody, that none of this will work without American leadership. But we all know that if it simply seems, as I said earlier, to America dragooning other countries into signing up, then it's not going to work at all. And for us all, Europe, Japan, South Korea, Australia, New Zealand, UK, to be working together, to be sharing information, to be sharing concerns, I think is hugely important. I'd like to know how many other countries have made a real fuss about hostage diplomacy, about the way the Chinese have behaved with those two innocent Canadians who have been locked up. I'd like to know how many countries, when the Chinese behaved as badly as they did about the Nobel Peace Prize, immediately shouted, "You can't do that." I'd like to know how many countries made clear after Australia was threatened with all sorts of economic sanctions because it asked for a WTO examination of what happened with the coronavirus. I'd like to know how many countries made a fuss and said, "We're on Australia's side." So I think it's terribly important that we talk to one another, that we work together, and that we share not a determination to build a Cold War wall around China, but we share a determination to ensure that when China doesn't pay by the rules, when it breaks its word, when it behaves intolerably, then we call it out. And I think we should be calling out now at the UN and the Human Rights Committee, whatever one says about the way their activities have been distorted over the last few years, I think we should call out China on Hong Kong, and above all, perhaps on Xinjiang, where what we're seeing is by UN definitions the equivalent of genocide.
And indeed, you have given us a really excellent framework here, and it's an alliance framework. And by the way, people have asked about the Five Eyes. These are the closest cooperative intelligence relationships, I think, in the world, US, UK, Australia. I think that what we now face is a question of whether we have A, the will and the patience, and indeed the ability to have a nuanced policy toward China. How do we do it? Do we have that will? Can you see us? I've always believed free peoples will ultimately win, but free peoples have to organize themselves properly. Any final thoughts on free peoples and the challenge from China?
Well, free people aren't always very good at organizing themselves. And it's maybe easier. There's a wonderful novel by Rex Warner called The Aerodrome, which I always used to think about whenever I met Lee Kuan Yew or went to Singapore. There's a terribly, a sort of rickety English village full of yokels, all behaving rather badly all over the place. An aerodrome is opened at the edge of the village. There's a very smart squadron leader who comes in it knocks everything about, knocks everything into shape. But somehow the freedoms, the liberties which have infused this English village full of yokels managed to survive. But we do have to organize ourselves better. I find myself endlessly provoked by Mao Bani's arguments about the fact that the West has had it. I don't think we've had it. I think the ideas which have made us as successful as we have been continue to be sustainable. I think it's impossible to borrow from lots of other people's arguments, whether Martin Luther King or Nelson Mandela. I think it's impossible to cage, to lock up an idea. And one thing I really believe I learned when I was in Hong Kong is all the things I'd taken for granted as a politician before I went to Hong Kong are suddenly there and are the reasons for its success. The relationship between open societies, between freedom of speech, between freedom of assembly, between freedom of information, between accountability, between civil society, all those things come together and help to produce a successful, stable society and a successful economy. And it sounds like maybe a stupid thing to say that in my mid-40s, I learned that by seeing it working myself and by helping to organize it. And I still think if we only have the gumption to stand up for ourselves, what we believe in as representatives of open societies is bound in the long run to be more sustainable than technological totalitarianism.
Thank you very much. And thank you for that inspirational ending. Thank you for your many years of service to your country and to the world. And we were just incredibly honored to have you as a matter of fact, of the launch of our China Sharp Power project. And we invite you, when we can see people again, to come visit us at Hoover. We'd love to see you again. Larry, back to you.
Okay, well, thank you, Condi. I'll just close with the following points. First of all, many people have asked about Taiwan. We also have a project on Taiwan in the Indo-Pacific region. And I invite you to write to the Hoover Institution if you'd like to be put on the mailing list for either the China Global Sharp Power Program or a program and conferences on Taiwan in the Indo-Pacific region, or both. Secondly, I want to say to both of you that we've received a large number of questions, and I want to, many of them have already been answered or asked by Condi. Others, I just want the questioners to know, I will convey them to our two conversants. I've copied them all into a Word document, so you didn't waste your time in asking them. And many expressions of admiration for you, Lord Patton, for your remarkable devotion to the cause of freedom and human dignity in general, and the cause of liberty and the ultimate triumph of it, not only in Hong Kong, but in all of China. And Condi, if you'll permit me, since it's coming from a former Marine, I want the last words to be from him. Secretary Rice, I met you in Jordan. True to your word, your staff sent my Marines in Iraq dozens of containers of Ben and Jerry's ice cream, a much appreciated memento and gift of home for Marines who were conducting a very difficult mission. Always your fan. And so I will conclude by saying we are always the fan of both of you. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you all for joining us.